So good evening, everyone. It's great to see. Oh, we have a visitor from Bellingham. Hi, Bob. Great to see everyone out this evening. This is the first evening of our new Dharma Seminar series. And I'm going to read you the first line of the poem that we're going to be looking at. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. Anyone here? These are the first two lines of a very old poem from 5th century China. It's said to be the first Chinese Zen or Chan text. And it's called, in Chinese, Xin Xin Ming. And in English, Trust in Mind or Faith in Mind. I'll come back to the title in a minute. It's attributed to the third Chinese Zen ancestor, Sun Tzu. And it's not a text that's in our repertoire. It's not in our chant book. Michael and I first became acquainted with it at Great Vow Monastery in Oregon, where it's chanted pretty much every day, noon service. And I never liked it. Which is kind of funny because it's all about not having preferences. I didn't like it because of the translation and because of the way it was chanted in a very monotonous sing-song kind of way. So it never really grew on me. I never warmed up to it. Until I read a different translation by Richard Clark, which is the one we just passed out. And I came to appreciate it more. Quite a few years ago at our old Zendo, we did a study series on it, and I couldn't even find my notes from that. And at the time, there was only this one commentary called Faith in Mind by the Taiwanese Chan master, Sheng Yan, which this is from the library. There's a library copy if anyone wants to look at that. But since then, another commentary called Trust in Mind, The Rebellion of Chinese Zen, is the subtitle, by Mu Song has come out. And I find it quite helpful, and so I thought it would be good to revisit this text. Mu Song, despite the name, is not Korean-born. He's Indian, grew up in Delhi, and as a young man moved to the West in 1969, 70, something like that, became involved in the counterculture and trained as in the Korean Zen tradition for 11 years as a monk. And he's now a kind of independent scholar. I could not find any academic credentials or even where or with whom he trained as a Korean monk. There's very little biographical information about him, but he's a very clear and thought-provoking writer. And I think his commentaries are worthwhile. He's done one on the Heart Sutra, one on the Diamond Sutra, and now this one. So I will be making reference to it. And what I particularly appreciate is his long introduction, where he talks about the roots of this text in Indian Buddhism, which he calls the Dharma of Trust in Mind, the Taoist influence, because this was a time, the 5th century, when Zen or Chan was just getting started and being strongly influenced by the Taoist tradition. So he calls that part the Tao of Trust in Mind, and then the Chan of Trust in Mind. which is quite interesting and I think apropos in the sense that this was a time of political and social unrest, not unlike our own, and Buddhism is still new and still putting roots down in our culture in a similar way as it was in Chinese culture, which was a very different culture from Indian culture. And these Eastern cultures are very different from our own Western culture, but Buddhism is putting down roots and changing and being changed by our culture in the same way that it did, that it changed and was changed by Chinese culture. So what might this text have to tell us in our times, which are so fraught with aggressive stance-taking and opinion-defending? Is there a way to exercise discerning wisdom without having to pound someone else into the ground? Maybe there's something here for us to listen to. So, back to the title. Here are the two characters for Xin Qin. The first one on the left is faith or trust, which interestingly consists of this little part, which is a person, and this is a mouth, and these are sound waves coming out of the mouth. So it's a speech. And then a person becomes trust or faith. Can we trust our own words? You know, a promise is trust. And then this is heart, which of course in the Eastern traditions is both heart and mind. See, that's the four-chambered heart. And so they're both pronounced the same. Xin Xin, or Xin Xin. In Japanese, it would become Xin Jin. And then Ming, the third character, I couldn't find on Google Images to attach to it, but it's not so much a poem as an inscription. So the Dharma of trust in mind, the roots in early Buddhism of what we're going to be reading in this poem. This is the first, or at least said to be the first Chinese text that's written in Chinese in the vernacular without using extensive Buddhist Sanskrit terminology. But the underpinning of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths is quite plain to see. The first noble truth, of course, is dukkha, or suffering, or that pervasive feeling of dissatisfaction that characterizes our lives, our human lives. Dukkha is also one of what are called the three marks of existence. The other two being impermanence, anicca, and non-self, or anatta, or anatman. So impermanence is pretty easy to understand, isn't it? Even the most stable and seemingly permanent of phenomena are ultimately subject to change. All we have to do is sit quietly and watch our own minds, our own bodies and minds, and we see impermanence. But the other, non-self, is much more difficult for us to grasp. But if we look deeply into what is this body, what is this mind, we see that there is no self independent of the changing causes and conditions within which our lives come into being and pass out of being. So non-self doesn't mean we don't exist. It means we only exist in a way that's contingent on all other existence. It's as though we exist in a matrix of connection, right? Interconnection, which is always in flux, always changing. The second noble truth is that the cause of our dissatisfaction is our non-acceptance of impermanence and non-self. Our desire for existence to be otherwise, to be something we can hold on to. We want to hold on to what we want, and we want to push away what we don't want. So in other words, attachment to preferences and opinions gives us grief. Right? So that's the core message of the poem. The third noble truth is that there is cessation of dukkha, freedom from our dissatisfaction. And the fourth noble truth is that there is a way to that freedom, which is the Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, speech, conduct, livelihood, effort, concentration, and mindfulness. So this is the way, when Sangsan says the great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences, that's what he means by the way, the Eightfold Path. The way to freedom. Through the practices of the Eightfold Path, we let go of our self-centered clinging to our likes and dislikes. The emphasis in early Buddhism was on achieving a kind of personal liberation from samsara, samsara being that realm of suffering, through seeing deeply into our true nature, through seeing into shunyata in the Sanskrit, which is most often translated as emptiness, but arguably a better translation might be boundlessness. The impermanent and ultimately insubstantial nature of existence is what we mean when we say, when we refer to emptiness, and that all things come into being within what I call this matrix of interdependence with all other things, so that nothing has what's called own being. Yeah? So emptiness not being a void, but a kind of fertile, boundless manifesting. Yeah. As early Buddhism became more institutionalized and academic and inaccessible to the lives of ordinary people, the Mahayana school emerged, which emphasized the possibility of awakening for everyone, not as some far, far infinitely distant lifetimes away possibility, but in this moment, right now, the possibility of awakening, and also the sort of archetype, we could say, of the Bodhisattva as a being devoted to supporting the liberation of others. So this is also in the background of the poem we're going to read. One more thing that's in the early roots of this poem is the concept of the two truths, the perspective of the absolute, undifferentiated oneness, and the relative, the perspective of everyday life, the provisional, the specific, the particular. And these were articulated by the Majjhimika school of early Mahayana Buddhism by Nagarjuna, who was the founder. And these two truths, the relative and the absolute, aren't separate, right? They're simultaneously interpenetrating all the time. And living those truths, realizing and actualizing those truths, is the path, the practice of a bodhisattva right here in this everyday world. So this is something you're going to hear reiterated in this poem over and over again. But it's in the flavor and style of expression of Chinese Taoism. So it's a different kind of language. It's simpler, very concise. The Indian Mahayana sutras are very flowery and ornate and fantastic. And this is much more down to earth. I'll talk more about that Taoist influence next week. A little bit about Sangsan, to whom this is attributed. We don't know much about him at all. What's known is really in the territory of legend. But he was the third Zen ancestor after Bodhidharma, who was the Indian monk who brought this way of practice from India to China, and then Hui Ke, Bodhidharma's disciple, became Sangsan's teacher. All we really know is the legend of Sangsan's enlightenment, and it echoes the story of his teacher meeting Bodhidharma for the first time. Hui Ke came to Bodhidharma's cave, where he had been sitting for 7 years, facing the wall in the cave. Hui Ke stood in the deep snow outside the cave, and the legend is that he cut off his arm to convince Bodhidharma of his sincerity. And then he said, "My mind has no peace. I beg you, Master, please put my mind at rest." And Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind and I will put it at rest." Hui Ke said, "I have searched for my mind." He stopped first for we don't know how long, and then said, "I have searched for my mind, but I can't find it." And Bodhidharma replied, "I have completely put it to rest for you." Which is a great story. But I also really like the chorus, or the echoing story of Sangsan, who then, a generation later, approached Hui Ke to request his teaching. And Sangsan was said to have been suffering from leprosy. And the disease was seen as evidence of some karmic wrongdoing. And that's a way of thinking that we're not entirely free from even today. You know, often when people first get a terrible diagnosis, what do we think? What do they think? What have I done? What have I done? You know, how have I caused this? How did I let this happen? So Hui Ke begged, Sangsan begged Hui Ke to cleanse him of his wrongdoing. And Hui Ke replied, "Bring me your wrongdoing and I will cleanse you." So Sungsan paused to reflect and then said, "When I look for my wrongdoing, I cannot find it." Weiko said, "I have already cleansed you of wrongdoing." I find this particularly moving because it's a story of how we cling to our stories of our failings and inadequacies, our self-blame, our belief that we're fundamentally flawed in some way. But when we look deeply at those beliefs, we find, what do we find? Causes and conditions, reaching back generations. We can't find ourself, our personal wrongdoings. And in one moment of full, unclouded presence, we are free of our wrongdoings. So that's our author. It may be that he didn't actually write this verse, but some other person or persons wrote it as his teachings. We'll never know. But let's take a look at it. Would someone be willing to read the one thing just to say that the original Chinese isn't divided into stanzas. It's just four character lines over and over and over again, four characters, which is very concise even for Chinese, which is already a concise language. So it's very pithy. But could someone read this is just divided just to help us. Find our place. So could someone read the first section, Claire?
The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. When neither love nor hate arises, all is clear and undisguised. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth.
Thank you. So those are really famous lines. And once you're familiar with them and have heard them, you'll recognize them. They'll crop up in other Zen texts, Zen koans, and in Dogen's writing, Dogen being the founder of our school of Zen in Japan. From Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, Instructions to Zazen, he writes, "If there is the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion." So that's a direct reference to this old Chinese poem. The appendix to Musong's commentary gives 8 different translations. So it's kind of fun, if you like that sort of thing, to look at the differences. And I looked at yet another. Most of them translate this first line as simply, don't have preferences or avoid preferences. But Clark says, the great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to preferences, which I think is helpful. It's a little more manageable, don't you think? It is deeply part of our evolutionary heritage as embodied animals to be attracted to what we perceive as desirable and repelled by what's threatening. The trouble with our human minds is that we get attached to things that are not beneficial and are no longer beneficial. Right? And we get stuck in habit patterns of aversion that obscure present reality. So our view becomes distorted because we have such strong powers of memory and foresight. We become anxious that pattern is going to repeat, which sometimes becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, doesn't it? So bringing awareness to those habit patterns, those well-worn ruts of our preferences and opinions, is the work of our practice, right? So that we're not driven by them. We've all seen how the smallest stimulus can trigger just a cascade of thoughts and feelings, positive or negative, right? a word of praise can catapult us into heaven, and a word of blame or criticism can plunge us into hell. Just like that, right? So, as you'll see, this poem is about cultivating a kind of stability and equanimity so that we're not constantly being blown about by the eight worldly winds. I really like the eight worldly winds, or the concept of them. Pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. I like them because when I feel myself getting blown, I can go, whoops, oh, you know, that's blame. I'm getting blown by blame. Or I'm getting blown by loss or praise. Because that pretty much covers all the ground, doesn't it? Those eight worldly winds of the things that can blow us about. Okay, could someone read the next four lines, please? Anybody? Yeah, Remick, please.
If you wish to know the truth, then hold to no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind.
Thank you. So if we apply this same kind of understanding to those lines, we can see that it's not saying don't have a perspective or opinion. It's saying don't hold tightly to your own views. Realize that, like everything, your views are partial. Right? How can you possibly have the whole picture? Just one little person and one little point in time. Your views are partial and subject to change. Knowing this, you can have a perspective, but hold it with some humility and openness, knowing it's provisional. Openness to learning more, seeing other perspectives, not demonizing someone who has a different view, but being open to learning more about them and what has shaped their view. To constantly set up what you like against what you don't will create a lot of dukkha for yourself and for others. Here's just a simple little example that may be amusing. I used to get annoyed with Michael. For, how many of you drive a standard shift? Fewer and fewer. Okay. I used to get annoyed because he would lug the engine. You know how you're supposed to downshift going into the curve? Not once you're coming out of it. This is a little gender reversal. Until we really talked about how we learned to drive, and I realized how extremely fortunate I was to go to a high school, just an ordinary high school in New Jersey, that had a really good driver's education, including behind the wheel, as part of my schooling. Whereas Michael, on the other hand, learned in Calgary from Brian Beckwall, who was only 6 months older than he was. So no wonder. So I could hold this, you know, when this would arise in me, I would think of, you know, little Michael learning how to drive, a 16-year-old from Brian Beckwall, and I could smile. And all these years later, I don't really know if he's doing it less or if I'm just not letting it get under my skin. Could someone read the next four lines, please? Yes.
When the fundamental nature of things is not recognized, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. The way is perfect as vast space is perfect, where nothing is lacking and nothing in excess.
So here it seems that Sung San is taking the perspective of the absolute, right? The undifferentiated oneness. And yet, at the same time, there is particularity. The thusness of just each thing, each moment. On this cosmic scale, we don't look up at the sky at night and say, well, I don't like that star over there. I don't think it looks good in that constellation. I think it should be over there in that constellation. But how hard it is not to feel that we have to control and micromanage our immediate environment, right? Our family, our workplace. Let's keep going because we're... could someone... Bob, could you read the next... next six lines, please.
Indeed, it is due to our grasping and rejecting that we do not know the true nature of things. Live neither in the entanglements of outer things, nor in ideas or feelings of emptiness. Be serene and at one with things, and erroneous views will disappear by themselves.
Yeah. So we're so quick to categorize people. You know, just in our everyday lives, you meet a new person, and immediately that judging mind, that assessing mind, kicks in, and we start to attach little labels, and we close off possibilities for getting to know that person. As soon as we start doing that, probably all of us have done that at some point, and then, if we're lucky, we discovered that person who is so off-putting actually has other dimensions. You know, that they turn out to be funny or generous or talented in some way that we didn't even notice at first. So please don't think that Sung Tan is advocating a kind of blankness here. It's a dynamic openness. It's noticing when we get snagged by people, circumstances, our own conditioned thoughts and reactions, even our ideas about emptiness and Zen, getting snagged by those. And then gently but firmly we unhook ourselves. Right? Yeah. Catch and release. You know, just like fishermen who practice catch and release fishing and just very carefully take that hook out and release the fish. So we notice and we unhook. Six more lines, please, someone. Go.
When you try to stop activity to achieve quietude, your very effort fills you with activity. As long as you remain attached to one extreme or another, you will never know oneness. Those who do not live in the single way cannot be free in either activity or quietude, in assertion or denial.
So there's a really strong Taoist influence here, which we'll talk more about next week, but he's really describing the Taoist concept of a wu wei, or non-doing. You probably know from your Zazen practice that it's no use trying to wrestle your judging mind into submission, right? The more you try, the harder the mind pushes back. So you're not free if you let the mind jump about chaotically, and you're also not free if you try to tamp the mind down forcibly. Can you rest in a kind of alert spontaneity? That's what wu wei is. That's what's non-doing. You could say there's maybe an analogy to child rearing here, don't you think? I wonder if your approach to life and practice has been shaped by the messages you received as a child growing up. How does that affect your practice? Do you resist discipline? Or do you get a bellyache trying to do everything just right? Okay, one more section. Could someone read the next eight lines? Yes, Susie.
Deny the reality of things, and you miss their reality. Assert the emptiness of things, and you miss their reality. The more you talk and think about it, the further you wander from the truth. So cease attachment to talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know.
Thank you. So that first little section is a bit tricky, I think, and I'm not sure that this is the best translation. So after I looked at several other versions, here's how I would like to paraphrase it. If you insist that things of the everyday world don't exist, you miss the vivid particularity of each thing. If you insist that everything is empty, you forget that emptiness itself is empty. So it's like the simultaneous oneness and particularity of existence. You can see that sooner or later we have to stop trying to put it in words and explain it and simply pay attention to our moment-to-moment experience. And looking deeply, we will experience directly that truth of boundless, ever-changing, dynamic manifestation of life and death. We can begin to travel the changing landscape of our lives with a kind of confidence and resilience that goes beyond easy affirmations. So maybe you can begin to get a sense of what Tsang Tsan is calling trust in mind. Notice he doesn't say, don't stop talking and thinking. He says, don't be attached to talking and thinking. But it's probably a good place for me to stop talking and invite you to do a little reflection on this, as we usually do with these sessions. And what I'd like you to do, for those who might not have done this before, is divide into clusters of three people, and each person will have a turn to share a reflection, and I'm going to give you a little focus for that. This is a practice of speaking from the heart, you know, grounded in your life and practice. You don't have to be philosophical or zenny. And each person will just have the floor and the others will just listen. So it's not a discussion. And I'll ring the bell in between. You know, I'll give each, you know, 2 or 3 minutes each. And we'll just listen with respect and care. And then we'll agree not to bring up what someone said afterwards, just so people can feel comfortable sharing their reflections. And what I'm going to ask you to consider is to think, if you can cast your mind to an example of an opinion or a fixed view that has caused you some suffering in some way, or you've caused others suffering through your... This is your view. I mean, probably you've experienced other people's opinions as suffering, but think about, you know, your own some way. And think about, has that view or opinion opened up in some way or shifted or changed, become more multifaceted? And if not, how could it? How could it open up? How might that view become more spacious? Okay, any questions? Then do your best to cluster up into threes. Move your seats so you're facing each other in little groups of threes. So do that as quickly as you can.